Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Worms are persistent creatures in our lives. Stories of them abound throughout human history. They represent health and decay, fear and fortune, death and life. They are the main character of one of the most famous literary works by Edgar Allan Poe, The Conquering Worm.
So I've been asked to read a poem I've long forgotten by Edgar Poe. And its hero, the Conqueror Worm. Whose hero is this, one might ask? But as a hero falls short in my mind, to what tragedy a hero such as this might be, and to what man shall this hero belong? Through a circle that forever returneth in, to the self-same spot, lo, 'tis a gallant.
Hey you, don't help them to bury the lie. Don't give in without a fight.
Nematodes are non-segmented worms, and they are the most numerous multicellular organisms on Earth. Just a handful of soil will contain thousands of these microscopic worms. Many are parasites of insects, plants, and animals, including humans. The vast majority of them are poorly understood biologically. Early farmers used seaweed as a natural pesticide to protect plants and livestock against parasitic nematodes. The reason seaweed was an effective pesticide was unclear. More recently, studies have shown the chemical in seaweed, called betaine, prevents the worm from growing. But how betaine functions has eluded scientists. Today on the program, we present University of Utah scientist
Dr. Aud Silvana Peden, and I'm a researcher, postdoctoral fellow. I work under Professor Eric Jorgensen in the biology department.
She has spent the past 7 years trying to answer the question, why is seaweed an effective pesticide? On November 10, 2013, the culmination of her work was published online in the scientific journal Nature Neuroscience. Dr. Peden used a technique called genetic screens in a non-parasitic worm and identified two proteins that modulate how betaine kills the worm. When one of these two proteins is mutated, the worm becomes paralyzed and sometimes dies because betaine opens the second protein that then floods the worm's neurons and muscles. This is why it is a case of too much of a good thing. Excessive levels of betaine is toxic to the worm.
This story is just about serendipity. And you don't know, sometimes it's not the path that you chose in life that you're going to end up with. And so no matter what you do, you know, you just have to remember that sometimes God sends a worm.
Ode was born and raised in the African nation Gabon. There, along with her family and the rest of her village, she was plagued by parasitic nematodes. They can cause substantial suffering, particularly in children who suffer tummy aches when infested. The World Health Organization estimates 2.9 billion people are infected with nematodes. They also have a significant financial impact on agriculture worldwide and exacerbate the global food shortage.
Parasitic nematodes are not just a problem for the Africans, right? It is a big parasitic nematode causes. There's like a major economic burden all over the world, right? So mostly southern state have to go through because people lose their livestock and then they lose their plants. Like I say, it's not just people and animals. You also have plants, tomatoes and corn. Plant that just have attacked by parasitic nematodes. So people are trying to figure out a way also to improve the yield on their crop. And so and when you have worm killing all your plant all the time as a farmer, it is frustrating. So you want to make sure that you have better drugs to be able to control these parasitic nematodes.
Currently, available methods for controlling parasitic nematode infections are mainly based on chemical treatments, anthelmintics. However, the use of drugs has not been entirely effective and poses the risk of residue problems in meat, milk, and the environment.
And then another major problem with parasitic nematode is that there's a big problem with drug resistance, right? Those are irreversible. Once resistance happens, they're just going to keep multiplying. One multiplies a lot. So once resistance happens in one gene, this thing multiplies. The worm that we work with, one worm can give you 300 progenies.
Wow. So, is there a drug that's working right now?
So the drug that they're using, the last set, major group of drug that they use was, they call it ivermectin. And that drug came out in the 1980s. So until the new Novartis class of drugs, which happened, they released in 2009, there was really nothing else. So, and then there was starting to be issues with ivermectin resistance, and all there are many drugs in the market, but the issue is that they're resistant to this drug, and then you want to find new drugs so that you can control those that are now resistant.
Pharmaceuticals started making drugs to combat parasitic nematode infections in the 1960s and 70s.
So until before that time, you just use plant basically to control infestation. As you know, farmer or for people,
seaweed, right?
One of them would, like, people use tobacco, and we now know how tobacco functions. I mean, if tobacco is very toxic, it may even make the animal sick. But we know now how tobacco works because it's nicotine in the tobacco that paralyzes the worm because it binds to the receptor that is found in the worm muscle, and the worm become paralyzed.
I see.
So, and then people use wormwood, right? Also very toxic because of chemical in wormwood that, you know, it does the same thing. It just goes and binds to a receptor. A receptor here, you have to remember, is just the lock and key kind of deal. A receptor is like a lock that any molecule or drug will bind to and open it and then stuff like that. But then there's also been a long-standing for Correctel that said that seaweed are also able to kill parasitic nematode.
Can you tell a little bit of a story about why this worm has sort of permeated history?
I mean, I think that parasitic nematode were easy to be known as parasite because you can see them with our own eyes. Bacteria, ancient man couldn't see. You can see them without a microscope. But a worm, when you're infected with them, and then you, if you're a person, you go to the bathroom, you're going to see worm in your stool. Or if you're an animal and you're a farmer, you're going to see worm in there too. So it was really easy to recognize them as being a problem or causing a problem for man and his crop and best friend, you know, his animals. And I like to tell the story that I read in the Bible, which is found in the book of Jonah. Most people think about the story of Jonah and the whale as if it ended at the whale kind of aspect. But the end of that book actually tells us that God sends a worm to infect Jonah's beloved plants and kill it. So we go up to the time of the Assyrian in the Bible, and here they're telling you that they were already aware that nematode can infect plant and kill them. Otherwise, they would not have used that analogy in the Bible. And that bring up the point that parasitic nematode don't just infect people or animal, they also infect plant. And then we know that beside the health burden that they cause to African people or even southern United States or in Asia, but you also have an economic burden because farmers lose a lot. The yield of the crop is decreased because of the heavy infestation by parasitic nematode. Mm-hmm. And some of the plants that are heavily affected is things like corn and tomatoes. And
I have a question for you then. So you ended up in neurobiology and you ended up in the University of Utah, but you come from Gabon.
Yes.
Was there any particular personal reason that led you to study this particular worm, or was it more happenstance because it was a way to understand the brain?
Not all worms are parasitic, right? They're good. There's good worm. They have, you have like the good, the bad, and the ugly in a parasitic nematode, in a nematode species. And so the worm that I ended up here at the University of Utah to use genetics to understand how the brain functions, how we generate behavior through neurons communicating with each other. And so I did not start out to say, I'm going to study parasitic nematode, even though growing up, it was also, we all had our own humiliating moment having to face, you know, being infected. But it was a complete accident. That's how science happened. You never know where you're going until you get there. So.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and USU's Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services, ranked in the top 2% of graduate schools of education with degrees in elementary, secondary, and special education. More at cehs.usu.edu.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour,
a Thanksgiving feast of songs about food and drink.
Please, mister, don't touch me tomato. Please don't touch me tomato. Touch me yummy pumpkin potato. For goodness sake, don't touch me tomato.
I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Pack your bags and join us for the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Tonight at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Ironically, the same worm that attacked Ode and her family in Africa is now the focus of her career.
When we go in, during the summer and then we go to the village, I mean, we eat fruits and stuff, you know, pick them up. You don't even think about washing them or whatnot. But so somehow you get infected, right? But my grandmother always had the drugs, so it's not like we were not, you know, completely like paralyzed and then like couldn't function. It just like we... One day you wake up and then you just make a funny observation that scares mostly the first time. My aunt, who recounted her story again after I discovered the receptor, told me that when she was about five or so, she basically had her first encounter with a paralyzed worm stuck in her butt as she was trying to go to the bathroom. To her, that was death. So basically, she stood up from, you know, the bathroom, and then with her underwear on her knee, just start screaming and calling out to her grandmother to say, I am dying, this is death. And everybody thought, oh my God, she's been beaten by a snake, you know. So you live in the jungle, you think it is a green mamba or black mamba, or even, you know, worse, a Gaboon viper. It's like, Shilivi, what's going on? What? You're just like... No, I have a worm stuck in my butt. So something like that is just like, okay, that's what I say, that's what I mean by humiliating, you know, story where, I mean, we laughed about it. Nobody got severely, you know, it's like having a flu. You have it and then you get over it and then you move on.
Ode says her grandmother always had an anthelmintic drug on hand that worked by paralyzing the worm.
It seemed to make them worse because, of course, what this drug did is paralyze a worm, and then it was easy to expel them through the feces and stuff like that.
Well, thank you for that story. Yeah, that's it isn't really funny, is it? It's a really major problem, but everything has a humorous side perhaps.
Yeah. And when you're going through it, you don't see it as a major issue. I mean, you're not in bed for very, at least in my family, it's not like you're in bed, you know, stricken sick for a very long time. You have a fever, you have this and that, and of course the medicine was always there, but not everybody is that lucky. That kind of the major issue over African countries and over places, and people might have more severe parasitic nematode than, you know, the one that we had.
Well, let's get back to then how your particular discovery has potential to help this whole situation. Can you talk a little bit about what your discovery, just go in detail about the science behind this discovery, and then let's move into how this could potentially be a breakthrough for curing some of the things that you've been faced with even in your life.
So they've always been before they were any pharmaceutical company making drugs. People have always relied on plants. And then for most of the plant, we know how they function. Like in tobacco, which was very bad, it used to be given to cows and stuff, livestock. And it was, now we know that nicotine, which is found in tobacco, whether you smoke it or give it to cows, will go and block the receptor that sit on the muscle of the worm. And the worm become paralyzed, and then it's easy to expel. And the same thing is true with wormwood, which also has a very toxic chemical, and it's also able to paralyze the worm and then expel them. But the major problem with these two plants is that nicotine also has receptor in human. So when you give it to animal, everybody gets sick, the worm gets sick, the animal gets sick. So you couldn't really use them. These are not really good drugs to use. But they did make analog of this drug called levamisole that people use a very long time. But levamisole now is no longer being used as a parasitic drug because it's just way too toxic for the same reason. It binds to some of the same receptor that are found in people, and the toxicity level is just too high.
I see.
So you want to be able to find a chemical that only targets worm proteins. And that this is a key. It has to be, the best drug will be one that targets worm protein. And then also the issue is also a protein that will be withstand resistance issue, because a major problem in the field is that there's too much drug resistance. And once the resistance appear, it's not going back. So you had to have new drugs. And as you know, it is not easy to make these drugs.
It's very hard to stay ahead of the game.
Yeah. So where our work come was another common plant that is in the folklore that was known to be good against parasitic nematode, mostly plant, was seaweed.
The seaweed folklore proves true. Seaweed extract, placed around plants, such as tomato and corn plants, prevents infestation. As we stated earlier, the chemical in the extraction responsible for killing parasitic nematodes is betaine.
And this is where my work comes in, because while I'm trying to understand how a neuron communicate with each other and the muscle to modulate locomotion in this worm that is not parasitic, I identified a transporter, a molecule that is supposed to, whose job is to make sure that there's not too much betaine outside the cell. And that molecule, that gene, is called SNF3. You have to understand, I call them transporter because what their job is. They're supposed to just clean up the street, make sure that there's not too much of this chemical. And the transporter have always been very good target for drugs, because for people who take antidepressants, if you have depression and you take a drug known as SSRI, what you're doing is every time you take that pill, it's gonna go on and block the transporter that's supposed to clean up serotonin outside of your brain, outside of the cell in your brain. And so when you clean up, you don't have enough, and then your mood just goes down. So when you block it, then there's too much serotonin outside, then serotonin goes and open, those lock that in the neuron that's supposed to make you feel good. Then your mood lift up.
And that's how it works.
That's how it works.
And this is similar to,
and
to
this
your discovery.
This is the same gene that I found, but this gene does not transport serotonin. It's actually transporting this molecule called betaine. So this gives us a way to say, oh, now we have a model where you have too much betaine outside the cell. Does it have any effect? And then we found out that yes, indeed, it does have an effect in the worm, that it makes the worm to become paralyzed and very hypocontracted, sometimes resulting to death. And now you start asking the question, how does it do it? Because that has always been the issue. People could never figure out, can never find what the lock was. Everybody had the key, but nobody could find the lock. So we use genetics mutations in a worm again, and then we look for to look for that lock, and we found it.
O discovered the lock that turned out to be a protein called ACR23. Now she could explain how seaweed could lead to worm paralysis and death. Fortuitously for Dr. Peden, one of the two proteins she identified has already been used by the international pharmaceutical company Novartis to make a new drug called Zolvix to use against the worm. It is being sold in Australia. The problem is, after a few years, the worms become resistant to the drug. They have the ability to change their genome such that they can keep living in the presence of the drug. So the more ways or targets we have to kill them, the better, says Dr. Peden. She adds we have to make drugs that attack multiple facets of the worm biology. The genes she identified will provide new targets for better drugs. This work is a crucial weapon in the war against parasitic nematodes. She explains in more detail.
It turned out that Novartis made these drugs, and then they were trying to look for the lock to their drugs, and it turned out that the drug that killed parasitic nematode. And then it turned out that they actually found the exact same key. So here we are showing that, in fact, and then in my paper, we actually show how the Novartis drug works. Actually, the Novartis drug need to have the endogenous lock, so the lock that is found in the worm, in order to work. So we need both the chemical that come, that man made, and then you need the one that was natural together in order to open, to really open this lock and then kill the worm.
So the new drug from Novartis only has the one target, ACR23. Since she found many other genes that function with it, now Novartis can improve their drug by targeting these genes in addition to the one they already have. It is a combinatorial way of fighting the worms, says Dr. Peden.
They did not know, for instance, what does this thing normally do? So you're taking a drug from outside and then putting it on a worm that the man made, but what does it normally do? What is it required for? And this is a question that I'm still addressing in a Jorgensen lab, because now that we now know that, okay, we have this molecule, and now we can show that, oh, it's actually responding, it's there to respond to this chemical called betaine, and that normally, but if you put too much of it, it kills the worm. So you have to be very careful about how much of it you have around, that kind of idea. Here.
However, the point is to kill the worm, yes?
Yes, the point is to kill the worm. And they have to understand that most drugs that kill worm act the same way. They just
flood.
They flood the system, and then they also have tendency to just go for open things that are normally present in the worm. So it's never, they find a specific pathway and then they target that pathway. What most drugs do is every drug goes and bind to something that is already natural to the worm or to the person, right? You cannot have a drug will not, if there's nothing, so they find a natural pathway and they just overactivate that pathway, or you block that pathway. That's how the drug works. So then the reason you are able to kill the worm with this is because you're pushing the system way too far. So you are overactivating this receptor and then just causing the whole system to overreact and the worm become paralyzed. That's how most parasitic nematode drug work.
So that's fascinating. And how excited are you about this discovery and about what it means for your career and even possibly for a cure for something that's been affecting people and animals and, you say, plants for the entire existence of life?
Well, I mean, I'm very excited. As I tell at the beginning, I tell the story of God sending the worm to punish Jonah. And I like to think that betaine and this whole story is basically the worm that God sent me to maybe teach me a lesson. Because when you're a scientist, you think that you want to solve big question, right? How did the brain works and how thing. And then one day you find out that, you know, what you're working for is actually an issue that deals with parasitic nematode. At first, you refuse, right? You want it to be a very big story. You want it to be about the brand, about something sophisticated. But then the facts are the facts, and then you just keep having it. So, I mean, I left home about almost 20 years ago now to come and study in the United States, right? Hoping to be, I don't know, something much bigger, right? Big scientist. But I always tell people, since my doctorate is in pharmacology, I used to tell my grandfather, no, I'm trying to understand how a drug works. But, you know, and everybody who's a scientist who knows how this thing, you know, work is like you do a lot, but you don't really get that close to a drug or how a drug work. But I think that with this research, these genetics, I can actually say, oh, I did actually do that, right? Because now we can figure out a better way through new target, both the SNE3 gene that I have, Novartis didn't have them, for instance. So now they can make drug that targets SNE3 and the receptor. Then you have two things, right? You can block the transporter, you flood the system naturally, and then you can have the monopentyl drug that allow the lock to be easily open. And together, if you make such a drug, then you can kill the worm much faster. And then you're probably going to prevent a resistance maybe much faster. Because right now, just having one gene, it's easy to mutate. And then go back to the same old issue of resistance. But by having all of these other genes, and most of which I have not talk about of characterized, because I have many genes mutation, then we know that you have a lot more that the drug companies or whoever is interested in finding the drug can work with to make better drugs.
And so is that going to be where you take this research? You're going to discover more? You're going to go down the path of how many more genes? And
I already have. So all of these were discovered through genetic screens. So I have many mutants that I have not had time to characterize yet. This was to try to finish his story. So yes, there is a lot more to know, and that basically what I'm working on, like where in a worm, for instance, where in a worm is this lock express? Is it what neurons? And how is that neurons affecting the normal behavior in the worm? And these are questions that you really need to know in order to make better drugs, because then you're talking about specificity in terms of signaling, as opposed to just give the worm a drug and then we know that it's working, but we don't quite know how. This is where Novartis is now.
So you mentioned you spoke with your aunt in Gabon when you made this discovery, and was there a reaction by them to what this could mean in the village?
No. I mean, it was more of everybody reminiscing on when they were children and then be infected, because most of the time you just get infected as a kid. It's kind of very rare to have adult, at least from my personal experience, to have adult do this. So it was mostly reminiscent, right? People just say, oh yeah, I remember being infected by worm. And then you just laugh about it. So it's not, they don't talk about, oh yeah, this is, I mean, conversation don't go to that level of daydreaming about major discoveries. And it's just, oh yeah, that's nice, yeah. You know, Biami Song, like I said, nobody has a good memory of parasitic nematodes. So you just laugh at it and then looking back kind of deal.
Oh, with a little more research, maybe you'll get rid of those memories altogether in the next generation, eh?
Yeah, hopefully.
Turns out the University of Utah is the place to study the molecule betaine. Dr. Peden discusses the U of U scientists who helped form the foundation that led to this discovery.
So, Dr. Peden, I'm just wondering if there's anyone else at the University of Utah involved in studying this molecule, or if your lab, the Jorgensen lab, is singularly responsible.
Actually, before I joined the Jorgensen Laboratory in 2005, there were two groups at the University of Utah who were studying betaine in one form or the other. One person who since left the university was Professor Mary Lucero, who shown that has a couple publications where she showed that betaine does affect neurons, the behavior of the neuron, that they would stimulate neurons and generate a current. So if you put it on a neuron, they will generate a clone. So, and so she has a couple publication on that in the squid axon and squid neurons. And then another person who had worked on, again, the issue of the transporter, on the betaine GABA transporter in vertebrates. So basically the same molecule that I discovered in the worm, but is homonym, you can say, in vertebrate is actually called betaine GABA transporter because now it transports two things. And Steve H. White, who is in the toxicology and pharmacology department and also run the NIH anticonvulsant drug unit, they look for drug that affect, that can prevent epileptic seizures. And they found out that one of the chemical that they found they had would target the betaine GABA transporter, and that could function as an epileptic drug. But they still have to figure out exactly how this molecule functions. So you do have at least that what those things that made me push my study further, because I knew that you already have two groups here at the University of Utah who looked at this molecule. So there must be something big about it, even before I learned about the whole parasitic nematode aspect of it. And so it seems like, well, if you want to talk about betaine signaling, this is indeed the place.
When I hear about scientists doing lab work, it seems you guys go at all hours and you're always doing these sort of mystical experiments. And we all have maybe an image in our mind of what you look like doing it, but it's probably not very accurate. Can you just talk a little bit about what it means to be a researcher and work in a lab like this? Can you paint a picture for us? We don't understand. Demystify it, please.
I mean, it's not everything. It's like somebody making, maybe it's like somebody knitting a sweater, right? So you just keep, you're going to have to decide what kind of yarn you want or what style you're going to want, you know, what kind of stitch you're going to use at a particular moment. And, but at the end, ultimately, you want to make that sweater. So as a scientist, and then you have to plan. You plan ahead, you have a specific question you want to address, and then you think about the way that you can get at the answer quickly. And there's never one single way of doing something. So most of the time, I like to tell people that it's basically 95% failure and 5% success, right? So you just keep looking. And so if you're lucky, you fall in the 5%. As soon as you start. And if you're not, you just go through the 95%. But every time you just have to learn to stand up and then start over and start looking again. So that basically, I think that's the life of a scientist. We go at all hours because you set up an experiment, you'll never know, right? Unless you time, even if you time it right, you're gonna end up showing up on a weekend anyway, or late at night, or at some point, depending on what kind of science you're doing. So you have to be dedicated in some ways. You cannot say, I'm gonna work from 9 to 5. That's not really the life, at least at the postdoc level or graduate student level. You cannot just say, this is how we're gonna be. And it's probably, things are probably different in industry than in academia. In academia, you kind of just have to put that extra time in to make sure that you're pushing your work forward.
And while you're in the lab, are you highly engaged? Are you sometimes bored?
I mean, you go through periods when things are very intense, so you always do an experiment. And then you go through period when you're waiting because you will do something. If you're a geneticist, you start across, you know, you mate your animal, then you have to wait for them to have grandchildren, right? So all this time, because those are the ones that you're going to study to see if your mutation work and stuff like that. So, but during that time, unless you have plan B, and most of the time scientists have plan B, but sometimes, you know, it doesn't, or sometimes you don't, so then you just wait until you have those results. So for those time, yes, you just fumble your fingers. But for most of the time, you have to read too, because you cannot be a good scientist if you cannot read. I would never been able to make the connection between seaweed and betaines and stuff if I had not read, right, what other people are doing. Or will never really figure out that Novartis discovered this, the drugs and stuff like that, if I didn't read. So you do a lot of reading. So that's basically what you do between this time when you're not actively doing experiments. So you're just basically reading or writing grants or writing papers and stuff like that.
What is your personal relationship to worms? Do you ever have a relationship with a worm? Can you have a relationship with a worm when you're working with worms? I know you once said you frightened by worms even.
Yes, I am very afraid. I'm very afraid of worms, actually. Growing up, my grandmother always called me Ayema Yema, which means the idiot, because every time I saw a worm, I screamed. And for her, she never really understood why somebody who grew up in the forest would be afraid of any insect or worm, as I was. And the reason is that once you've been infected with parasitic nematode, you're afraid of what that is. And worm, at first sight, are creepy organism, right? I don't think that there's really anybody who can tell me that they love a worm. And so from that point, but then when I was in graduate school, we met this lady who was doing very cool science, very cool genetics, and she was using a lot of worm as a model organism to really understand, address big question. And I found that that was very, very cool. And I really wanted to do that, be able to do genetics in the worm. So after I got my doctoral degree in molecular pharmacology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I decided to move to switch and work to do genetics in the worm. And of course, along the line, overcome my fear. And I've come a long way. I still wear gloves in the garden so that I don't accidentally touch a worm. But those are not parasitic worm, and they don't really belong to the same species as parasitic worm. But it's a worm is a worm. And now, since I made the discovery, figure out a way how some of these nematocytes work, I have more respect for the worm. I will actually take the time to stop and then rescue a worm from a flood, mostly in the spring when it's raining and stuff. I'm still afraid of them. I still get a stick to move them out of the water. I'm not touching them with my hand. But that kind of my love and hate relationship with the worm outside of science.
Why is a worm such a good subject to try to understand the human brain?
You know, I think it is the people say that Nietzsche said, you may have evolved from worm to man, but much within you is still worm. And that is true, because a lot of the genes that are found in worms are also found in human, right? But they probably do the same thing. Maybe you have little changes then and there, but all of these genes are there. And they might be doing, maybe being in the wrong place. Like I explained that the lady that I'd met who was doing cool science with a worm, she was actually studying one behavior, male mating behavior in the worm, in C. elegans, which is a worm that we use as a model system. But then it turned out that the genes she was studying in the worm were actually involved. When they mutated, they cause kidney disease in human. That goes to tell you that, yes, you can use a worm to understand the nervous system. And as I will be saying all along this interview, and that you should never forget that sometime God used a worm. So there's nothing too little that cannot be used to understand man.
Thank you, Dr. Peden, very much.
We look forward to following Dr. Ode Peden's work and congratulate her on revealing our secret weapon against the attack of the parasitic nematode. Thank you for listening. Special thanks to Susie Montgomery for conducting this interview. I'm a beautiful story.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Square One Printing, 630 West, 200 North, Logan, personalized printing for home or business, including wedding announcements, thank you cards, and family histories. Information at squareoneprinting.com, and by the USU 4-H extension and youth programs, junior master gardener programs, providing a hands-on approach to learning horticulture, environmental science, leadership, and life skills. Information at utah4h.org.
This is Sherry Quinn. If you want to know what kind of cheese to serve at your next dinner party, listen up. Today on the program, we visit Whole Foods grocery store in Salt Lake City and talk to cheese buyer Andrew Fitzgerald and marketing specialist Lydia Martinez. Andrew has somewhat of an obsession with cheese, and it will pay off at your dinner table.
I eat cheese 5 times a week. And prosciutto if I have it on hand, too. I love cured pork.
And what cheese does that go well with?
Depending on which prosciutto I have, my current favorite thing to eat is, it's actually not prosciutto, but salami. I'm going to plug my friend Cristiano Carminelli, who's a local salami producer. He does small and large format stuff, but Cristiano makes the best salamis I've ever had in my life, and so I love the opportunity to sit down with a soprassata salami, which is the white wine and garlic, and then a piece of the quadrella di bufala, and just sit in the backyard in a chair on the grass and just enjoy a little meat and cheese in the afternoon. It's a wonderful thing.
In any type of milk, whether it's mother's milk or cow's milk, there are enzymes that are called opioids, which are related to opiates. There is a lot of value in having a baby mammal addicted to its mother's milk, because you want to make sure that, you know, it's just nature. It's making sure that that baby is going to feed and grow. And that's why it's so hard to wean children and wean animals off of milk, because they're literally addicted to it. Now, you take that milk and you concentrate it in cheese. It takes way more milk to make, say, like a hard cheese, like a Parmesan, than it does to make a soft cheese. So the more milk that's in it, the more concentrated those enzymes are, and the more addictive the cheese is. So yes, cheese is literally addictive.
Yeah. It's fun. I'll see friends at their jobs update their Facebook page via their iPhone or whatever and say, oh my God, I need a piece of, you know, and then insert whatever cheese right now. And it always makes me laugh. I'm just like, yeah, I could go for that too.
Well, and it hasn't hurt your figures either, so that's a good selling point too, right?
I gotta ride my bike a little bit more, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but and snowboard more in the winter. But it's, yeah, I mean, good food should be really important to everybody. I mean, that's my opinion at least. When you get into cheese, age is flavor.
There's a very famous cheese quote that says, age doesn't matter unless you're a cheese. You really want cheeses aged to perfection for the fullest flavor, and whether that means that it hits its peak flavor at a very young age, at you know, 60 days, or whether it doesn't hit its peak flavor until it's been aged for 2 years, if it goes under or over that kind of key time frame, it's just not going to be as good. It'll still be wonderful, but it won't be as good. And so that's one of the reasons why you really want to go in and get to know your local cheesemonger, because they can tell you this cheese right now is at its absolute peak. This is the best time to buy it. This is the best time to get it. And it makes a big difference.
And can you talk about flavors, and what is it about cheese flavors that are so appealing, and what are the most popular flavors?
Well, flavors will come from like anything from like, you know, like where the milk is being sourced from, and then the cultures that are being added to it will help develop in flavor. How the cheese is aged will take an effect on the flavor of it. Like if you're getting into like a washed rind cheese that has a bacterial rind, those cheeses are, they're defined by their stinkiness. So like your cheese like Taleggio or a Poise, ones that kind of smell like dirty socks. With that one, what's interesting, there's two things I find interesting about that. The appeal of that cheese to people is that almost rot and decay kind of smell that's actually kind of good. Then you got to think back to like, well, humans were at one point scavengers, so perhaps that's where it appeals to us. I know that for my friend Matt, a good piece of Taleggio will make him hungry if he smells it, whereas you give that to someone who's more sensitive and not into cheese, and that'll make them lose their appetite. And then the other thing that's interesting too is that the bacteria that is used on these washed rind cheeses is actually extremely similar to the bacteria that's secreted in human sweat. So that's part of why it smells so similar. And it's the same thing. I mean, to some people it's kind of appealing and some people it's not.
Another thing that very much affects flavor, it's the most basic thing, is what animal the milk comes from. So you have cheeses that come from dairy cows. You have cheeses that come from sheep or from goat's milk. Buffalo milk is another one. And all these different types of milk, they have different milk fat in them. They have different levels of milk fat. They have different flavors. How those different milks age in a cheese also affects it. And then the other thing that really affects the flavor is what those animals were raised on, what they ate. And so milk from a cow that has been feeding in the spring on rich, green, fresh, tender grass, that milk from that animal will taste very, very different when that animal is feeding on things like straw and grain in the wintertime. And so the flavor of the milk from the same animal can vary from season to season as well, and that affects the flavor, the mouthfeel, and ultimately those subtle nuances, the undertones in the cheese.
Another good example would be like Quick's Cheddar, which we carry here, and it's in 2008 it won the Queen's Award for being a wonderful representation of Great Britain. But this cheese has this wonderful kind of sulfury cooked egg taste, which is part of what you get out of a good appropriately aged cloth-bound cheddar, where it's actually wrapped in butter-soaked bandages and then aged in that way, as opposed to being vacuum-sealed like you'll get like with your block of cheddar from like Tillamook or whatever. And so the flavors that you get out of it, though, in addition to that, is you'll notice like a really distinct kind of asparagus and then this really great mustardy kind of horseradish finish. And it's, these are all things that are influenced by what the cow's been eating. And so you can eat that and you can compare it against like Cabot cloth-bound cheddar out of Vermont, and that one's going to have that same great sulfury eggy kind of taste, and then it has this really distinct kind of artichoke kind of flavor.
One of Andrew's favorites is water buffalo milk cheese, because he says it is not gamey tasting. Apart from Italy, its birthplace, buffalo mozzarella is made across the world. Countries all use milk from their own herds of water buffaloes. Italy and Bulgaria have the best dairy water buffaloes, according to many scientists.
Gamey is such an off-putting term, though. It's not as free-range tasting. But water buffalo milk has almost twice the fat solids that cow's milk has, so that's going to end up influence that you're going to get more texture, you're going to get a richer mouthfeel, that's going to be this more kind of enveloping experience with it. And so the cheese that I have been in love with for a while is called Quadrello di Bufala, and it's a washed rind cheese that's made in the Piedmont region of Italy. It's from the neighboring to Lombardy, which is where Taleggio comes from, very famous stinky cheese. It's made in that exact same style, but it's made with water buffalo milk instead of cow's milk, and it just has this different dynamic to it. When that cheese is at room temperature and you pop a piece and you're sitting there chewing on it, and it's just like, it's this crazy, like it envelops your senses kind of experience.
It's very, very rich without tasting sharp.
Yeah.
In any way. So sometimes people don't like sheep's milk cheeses or goat's milk cheeses because they taste a little bit sharper to the tongue, but you don't get that at all with buffalo. Well, you still get the creaminess and the richness that you don't always get necessarily with cow's milk.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you wash rinds. You take the time to do
Yeah.
Where most people don't. And can you talk about that and why that's important?
Oh, it's so important. When they come in, particularly the Taleggio and the Quadrello, when they come in, they're wrapped in paper. And they're not vacuum sealed or anything, but they're wrapped up in paper. And these are cheeses that have been on, you know, a boat from Italy to the U.S. and then stored for who knows how long. But, I mean, like let's just say at minimum they've been for 3 weeks not getting to be in their ideal environment, which is like a really high humidity environment, like 90%, and sitting at about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. What happens is that the rind on these cheeses are live and active, and they have this wonderful brick orange color to them when they're healthy. And instead, when they get here and I unwrap them, they're covered in fuzzy molds that are not necessarily edible, and the rind is I wouldn't say dead, but it's dormant. And so what's happening is that the cheese is no longer allowed to develop anymore in flavor, and then also you can't eat the rind. So that's kind of two negatives. And so what I end up doing is I get them in, and then I wash them with a saline solution, so a little bit of salt and water, and make sure that I get into all the crevices and whatnot on the rind, and make sure that I'm not actually scraping away the mold, because I'll be taking away the actual bacterial rind as well. By revitalizing the bacterial rind, it actually in turn will kill off the mold on its own. And so what's cool is by doing that, and then I just wrap them in plastic and just put them in my little reach-in cooler so I can keep an eye on them, and I flip them and whatnot. The bacterial rind is anaerobic, so it doesn't need oxygen. And so what's cool about that is that you're denying air to the mold, and then you're also providing fuel to the bacteria. And then the cheese will, as opposed to just sitting there and continue its process of dying and losing moisture, instead it will continue to develop in flavor and everything. I cut into a wheel of Quadrello like a little over a month ago, and the day that I took it out and knew that it was time to cut into it, I was thrilled because it just looked magnificent. It had this great brick hue to it, and it was, I mean, it stunk through the wrap, and I cut into it, and I had a little piece, and I was just like, oh my God, this is probably the best piece of Quadrello I've ever had in my life. And it was just, you know, and immediately, like, let everybody know that I knew. I was like, you can come in and buy a piece of cheese from me today. Like, this cheese is unreal. I mean, that's the reason to do it. You want people to be able, like, when they're buying, like, they're paying $22 a pound for Quadrello or $17 a pound for Taleggio. You want them to get their money's worth. So, I mean, if that means a little bit extra work on my end in order to provide them with the best product possible, then so be it.
And how important is the packaging and the different, why some are in paper, some are in plastic, some are in tin foil? Or?
Ideally, cheese shouldn't be wrapped in plastic, to be quite honest. It has to be wrapped in plastic here in Utah because of our low humidity. But if you were to go to like New York or whatever, you would find cheese displayed unwrapped. We have to wrap things in plastic in order, you know, to protect ourselves and whatnot, protect the product, but then also to preserve the product. But if you were to buy a piece of cheese, I mean, ideally what you would do is then take it home, and it kind of depends on what kind of cheese it is, but generally if you keep it in like a Tupperware as opposed to wrapped up tightly in plastic, it allows the cheese to not kill itself, because as it sits there wrapped up, it's giving off certain gases and whatnot. They have nowhere to go when they're wrapped up in plastic, and so that'll actually cause the cheese to spoil more quickly.
Yeah, Tupperware, or you can get like glass cheese domes that work really, really nice, and will your cheese will last almost double the amount of time without molding or spoiling if you're storing it properly, which is not tightly wrapped in plastic. And then the other thing about cheese to keep in mind is that serving it, most cheese is best served and you get the best flavor at room temperature. So a lot of people will pop some cheese out of their fridge, cut into it right away, and then they're surprised that the flavor isn't what they wanted it to be or hope it to be. You know, the real trick is to let it sit out for an hour or more on the counter, bring it to room temperature, and that's when you're going to get your best flavor of your cheese.
That was Lydia Martinez and cheesemonger Andrew Fitzgerald. Thanks for tuning in. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah.